And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Rick Falkvinge about the Pirate Party, the Pirate Bay, and the whole situation in Europe and international, really, in terms of surveillance, you know, kind of where this is developing, net neutrality and everything else. And we have a bunch of things we want to continue to talk more about in terms of basically where this is going and what the future of the web holds as well. There's some issues in terms of surveillance with the NSA, Snowden, WikiLeaks that I hope we can get you to a little bit later as well. But how do you see the development of the web here then in the next few years? Because to me, Rick, it really is like a fork in the road at this point. And there are, you know, a couple of different directions that we can take here. And I guess just to play the devil's advocate a little bit then, let's assume that there is a threat of you know, security or terrorism, whatever you want to call that. I mean, I'm on your page in that. I think that if you do look into the situations that we've had, it's very, you know, it points towards sting operations. It points towards other things that has to do with false flag attacks and everything else. But at the bottom line, if we had completely secure data, you know, messaging back and forth, if there was no overseeing that, would there be any potential threat in that, do you think, Rick?
Well, we've always had that. I mean, it hasn't even been seen as something negative. It's been seen rather, it was even part of our identity, at least in Western Europe, when I grew up during the Cold War. It was reading people's mail was something you did in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and it was held as civil liberties were held as sacred. So asking the question, would it be acceptable for people to communicate in private? I think the fact that that question is even asked shows how much the world has changed in 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important to realize that the encryption exists, and it is possible to communicate in private if you want to. We have a number of technologies that are well ahead of the security and spy agencies. The problem is mostly that most people don't use them. Meaning that if you want to communicate in private, we can do that. We know how to do that. And I think it's good that we know how to do that. If you want one example, Edward Snowden was able to walk out with the NSA's entire treasure chest without them realizing because of encryption and handing it over to the press. Now, because of this data collection that we've been talking about, Edward Snowden was smart enough to realize that they would be on his tail soon enough, so he'd be better off going public about who he was and why he did it. In that aspect, these spying agencies have killed off freedom of the press because there's no such thing as an anonymous source any longer. Even if reporters can't or have a right to protect their sources, you can just look at who was communicating with whom and sees, for example, who from the Defense Department was calling this reporter. You don't even have to go to the reporter anymore to get the source. But is there a downside to people communicating in private? Yes, of course there is. But I'm not going to claim that it's anywhere. Let's put it this way. We've seen a number of societies historically where the opposite has been true, where ordinary citizens have not been allowed to communicate in private, and where governments have conducted their business entirely behind closed doors with no transparency and no accountability. And they've all been, shall we say, low happiness societies.
Right.
It turns out that if you want a long-term, not just happy, but productive society, then you need accountability of the elected leaders. And in order to have an accountability of the elected leaders, you need the ability to think and communicate in private. At the end of the day, this boils right down to democracy, because the instant our elected leaders have the ability to hold voters responsible for what they think and the opinions they hold, and by extension, how they vote, then the entire power pyramid is turned brutally and violently upside down.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Ben Franklin, right, who said those who sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither. And that's really where this ends up. And as we've seen so many times, you know, paranoia and suspicion that someone will challenge, you know, the effective power in charge and ultimately their control goes overboard. And that's eventually also what leads to their demise, I think, you know, the different factions of the political spectrum that we've had, you know, throughout the last 200-300 years, really. And we see this power struggle back and forth and the paranoia about the other side. But there has to be some kind of realization that you have to let people, you know, think what they want, you know, and
yes,
and they have to have hold their opinions. But see, it's being attacked from many different angles at this time as well, because as you have the hardcore kind of censoring of things as well, you have an attack of political correctness coming in from the other side as well. So, you know, are we going to be able to get out of that situation, do you think, Rick, or are we pretty much, are we in for that, the paranoia and suspicion from the power hungry elite right now, so that they will, you know, try to clamp down even worse, and eventually this will lead to another, I don't know, bloody revolution or something like that? I mean, we've seen it in the past, as you said.
Well, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, because you don't see everybody in the streets outraged about this yet, like you did, for example, in East Berlin right before the fall of the wall. We're not there yet. And if it's one thing that causes a change in policy and does so on a dime, then it's the threat of replacing a politician. If, let's put it this way, the first problem a politician tries to solve is getting elected.
Yeah.
The second problem a politician tries to solve is getting re-elected. And whatever is third is so far behind those first two that it doesn't really get on the agenda. So the only way to cause change in policy, in my experience, and this is fully possible, but I just want to be really cynical and results-oriented for a moment. The only way to cause change in policy is to threaten to kick politicians out of office. If there's a credible threat to their job, then policy will change. However, the converse is also true. If there is no credible change to their office, then policy will not change.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I don't think people in general have realized and put it in context just how bad it really it already is. To take one example, you have the German police that were using so-called Bundestrojaner. They were essentially infecting computers at home in order to read documents and whatnot that were stored on those computers. Now, a computer today is much, much more personal than, say, a diary was 20 or 30 years ago. I mean, could you see police breaking into people's homes and reading their diaries, even when, if they weren't under suspicion of a crime?
No.
Right. And so, and yet it goes beyond that. I mean, if you have control over somebody's computer, then you also have control of what's connected to that computer. And things that are typically connected to your computer today include microphones and webcams. And that puts us right in the scenario where a government has cameras in people's homes. There's just one exception. There's just one key difference to this horrible scenario that was fairly common in dystopic novels in the 1950s and 60s. In the book 1984, it was called Telescreens. In other books, it had other names, but the key theme was the same, that the government had cameras into people's living rooms. We're there now.
Yeah.
We're there now.
Yeah.
With one key difference in how this developed. We bought the cameras ourselves.
Exactly, yeah.
And I don't think anybody was able to predict that.
It's a voluntary act in this regard, and therefore it's seen as a non-threatening thing, right? So it's very clever. I mean, obviously there's different sides to the technology and tremendous, you know, benefits in terms of, you know, connecting and communicating with people. But the bottom line, as you're getting to, which is very important, is that we've walked right into this situation with perhaps out even thinking about the shadow side to this, right?
Absolutely. And I don't think people in general are thinking in terms of information hygiene, as in, if I'm giving up this piece of information, who else can see it? If you take the example of entering your PIN code into an ATM, who else can see that PIN code? Well, the coder of the ATM is forwarding this code to the bank. And what's done in addition to forwarding it to the bank, you have no way of knowing that. Because once you've given a piece of information up, you've sort of relinquished control over it. It's the same thing as if you publish something on the net, you've given up control over it. If you publish something digitally at all today, you've given up control over it. So this, again, ties right back into the copyright monopoly debate. And there's this saying, what goes on the net stays on the net. And the people growing up today, the teenagers today, understand this. But people who sort of were introduced to computers at an adult age, I don't really see them thinking in terms of information hygiene. And I think that's also why we don't take the surveillance day, this mass surveillance, as seriously as we should today.
Interesting. Yeah. It's a very good point. Now, let's see if we can get into what happened in terms of, again, I want to try to tie this back a little bit to the environment in Sweden for our international audience kind of thing. But with WikiLeaks, with Assange, the rape charges against him, and again, how a lot of these things have been kind of circling around Sweden in one extent or another. Has it been kind of a testing ground a little bit? Because just what you said, the rollout of broadband, this kind of general culture has been kind of ahead of the bell curve a little bit in Sweden, and therefore the testing ground for seeing, all right, where can we, you know, push when it comes to surveillance and these aspects, has that been mm-hmm. a little bit ahead and tested in Sweden as well, do you think?
Sweden has had a spy agency that's been cooperating with the United States for a very long time. The Swedish FRA, the NSA equivalent in Sweden, was wiretapping satellite phone calls since at least 1976, completely illegally, by the way. And I know that because I wiretapped the over-director of the Swedish FRA saying just that. Kind of ironic. But
did you release that on somewhere, by the way, or...?
I did, and absolutely nothing happened, which was a huge disappointment. but yes, I have the admission of the over-director of the Swedish NSA equivalent admitting that they were illegally wiretapping wholesale and that they knew they were doing so illegally. In any case, you were talking about Assange and those cases. And I think that taps a little bit into the Swedish culture, which would be relevant for international listeners. Sweden is a fairly small country, but it's quite intolerant in terms of deviating from the public consensus. This country is very, very consensus focused, and one of the worst social gaffes you can do is to disagree with that consensus. Both in a small setting, such as friends or colleagues gathered around coffee, or in the large setting, as in challenging the establishment's view on whatever, where a consensus has been achieved.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And this is also why there's a lot of prestige in this society. Much more so than in any other setting I've seen, actually. And I think the Assange case needs to be seen in this context, where you had a prosecutor who opened a case and was defied by an international rock star who moved to London and essentially who said that I'm available. If you want to talk to me, you can come here at any time. And being defied as an authority figure like that doesn't come over well at all with certain wannabe important people and Swedish authorities. So it became a game of prestige that was very, very destructive. I mean, this case has been open for what, 3 years now? No, it was 2010. It's coming into its fourth year.
Yeah.
And we know that Swedish prosecutors are going abroad all the time to hold hearings with people that have been accused of things, but not Julian Assange, because there's been prestige going into this. It's gone so far that one important ex-prosecutor even had a huge op-ed in one of the largest Swedish dailies the other day, saying that this is causing Sweden to look terrible on the international arena. We're making fools out of ourselves. It's time to close this case because it's obvious that it would be closed right after the hearing. And to break consensus like that for an ex-prosecutor is a very, very large step in Sweden. I know it's not in the US or it's not in France or a number of other countries where there's actually a live and quite passionate debate. But that's not the case here.
Yeah.
And I think that also goes to explain why this wiretapping has been able to go on for so long and been built up for so long. Like I said, 1976, it's almost 40 years ago. And that's this sense of elitism within the establishment. It moves to protect itself, pretty much like the 1% does in the United States. It puts up a riot fence around itself and protects its privileges. I'd say that the richest 1% in the U.S. might be the closest equivalent I can think of.
Sorry to interrupt, Rick, but that's a really good point, actually, because it shows from a different point of view, I think, to our listeners who don't understand that dynamic within the country, that it's just we have that in place already. It's just of a somewhat of a different nature. I mean, it doesn't exactly come as much in the shape of corporatism, although that's very prominent in Sweden as well, the tie in between government and business, certainly. I mean, more there than in other countries. But it shows that it's the same there. And I think a lot of people have been looking at Sweden as a role model in terms of democracy and human rights and everything. This is the dirty dust that's been swept under the rug that people don't know about on the international scene that very much look towards Sweden. So it's very good that you bring that up, you know.
Yeah, I think you have a point. I mean, there's certainly a lot of corruption in Sweden. It just takes a different shape than what most people look for.
Yeah.
So, if where the 1% in the United States are shaping this riot fence around themselves using economic power and some bought regulations, in Sweden that establishment is shaping the riot fence around themselves using socio-political power and the exercise of authority.
Yeah.
So, again, a consensus that authorities should act in a certain manner to safeguard society's values and so on. So, to bring back corruption, I mean, there are places on the planet, a lot of places, with monetary corruption, where you have to buy certain services that aren't supposed to be bought, but so on and so forth. In Sweden, there's practically none of that, none whatsoever. However, there's a lot of friendship corruption that ties directly into this establishment dynamic. And essentially, you need to know somebody on the inside, not just to get a job, but practically also to get a place to live and even to get proper health care, or at least to move ahead in the operations queue in health care.
Yeah.
And To you, coming from Sweden, that this is perfectly natural. But I mean, coming from somewhere else, it's a definite eye opener. And given the choice between the two systems, I definitely take the monetary bribes, because you have a chance to move grow into such a system. You have a chance to move to that country and learn the system and start fitting into it at an adult age.
Yeah.
Whereas people who come here at an adult age are doomed from the start, because they don't have the connections that give them access to the system.
Yeah.
You can't get them at an adult age, because you get them in your teenage years.
Yeah, very good point, Rick. Is there anything more you want to add to that?
No, I mean, we were talking a bit about the Swedish context, and I think this, I can't say for sure that this goes for Norway and Denmark as well, but Scandinavian culture is fairly homogeneous in that matter. So just like you say, Scandinavia is kind of looked at as the social utopia by many people, I think you're right in the fact that there should be everything isn't gold that glitters. Now, obviously, coming from Sweden, it's easy to criticize it, because I've seen the downsides with my own eyes, but I haven't lived at length anywhere else, so I should highlight that I can't really relativize it and say with a definite point that this is better or this is worse, but I think it deserves highlighting.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I've lived in other places, you know, and I see it with a clarity now that I didn't before, and I think one of the points on that as well is I've noticed that when I'm in discussion with people, those who have come from abroad specifically and then moved into Sweden, they tend to agree with me almost 100% right away. But when you are in conversation with the Swedish citizens and those who've only lived there for all their lives, they're very much in defense of that system, and that speaks to that homogenization and the appeal that authority has within the country, that they've managed to build this up to a tremendous extent. And I believe as well, Rick, that one of the reasons then that internationally Sweden and Scandinavia, the Nordic model, is looked at as being a very, you know, beneficial one to the outside world right now, is because it has been somewhat of a political and social laboratory. And at this stage, they've come to the conclusion that, all right, if people are, you know, in adherence with authority this much to that extent, and if that has been aided by the system around them, then yeah, let's export that out to the rest of the world, or other countries will import it. And hopefully that will lead them to homogenize the country in a very much the same way. And therefore, I've been speaking out about this tremendously and saying, kind of warning about that, and just pointing to, you know, just what you did with the corruption and everything else to help to highlight that to people who think it's, you know, very much a clean system, but it's not.
I think that's a very valuable reflection. And I'd have to agree with you completely in the fact that people who have only seen Sweden tend to buy these, well, lies, frankly, about how superior Sweden is, which you hear all the time. Almost, I mean, it's almost humorous. You hear it North Korea style, how Sweden is number one in the world, blah, 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 blah. Pretty much like you'd hear in the United States, I imagine, like go United States, go United States, go United States, which isn't true either, right? So the difference is that you can stay in the U.S. for all your life and see a lot of diverse cultures, a lot of diverse environments. Sweden is a fairly small country. Its population in total is smaller than the population of London. So it comes more naturally to travel a bit and get some perspective on the claims that Sweden is superior in every way. And once you get that perspective, you see that that's not the case.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's very much the same. I don't want to, you know, mull on that point for too long, but just this idea that it's, you know, we've developed a social model with the folkhemmet, the people's home, for many, many years. And that has been the best way of operating things. And now it's just basically, we're just waiting for the rest of the world to catch up with us, because we have, you know, we're spearheading that model and it's the best one. But there's been plenty of books written about this, you know, the, what is it called again? The, I forget what that was called now. It's one of the British authors that wrote about how basically democracy have been destroyed within the Swedish system, which was a very interesting, perspective. The New Totalitarians, by the way, is that book.
I gotta read that.
Yeah, that it's a really good, beyond the history chapter, which I don't agree with Swedish prehistory, but that's another story really. But beyond that, The New Totalitarians by, I'm going to bring up that name here later. It really shows that idea and that background we have in that. So with that said though, Rick, do you think that things are changing within that cultural framework on the social political scale within Sweden, or is that so much in place and so firmly there that it's going to take generations before that begins to budge? Where do you think this is going?
I think it has started to change. I mean, when I grew up, this mechanism was so much stronger. The establishment could essentially assert that the earth was flat if they had wanted to, if it would have benefited them. But to teenagers growing up today, it's not just natural that they go to Denmark or Norway or Finland or whatever next state. It's normal that teenagers go to Australia or China or Mongolia or Siberia, the world has become so much smaller. So you can't maintain a monopoly on truth any longer. And I think that's wholly positive. There is this quote that I sometimes bring up, and I think it might be appropriate at this point, from Commissioner Pravin Lal, saying that, "Beware of him who seeks to deprive you of information, for in his heart he dreams himself your master."
Yeah.
And I think that's wholly appropriate. I think we're definitely seeing cracks in the facade in this construct. We're seeing a lot of truths, these consensus truths being challenged by something as impolite as facts and research. It's like some people said in the United States that facts have a liberal bias.
Well, that certainly works in the opposite direction as well, Rick.
I think that was quite a funny quote, without saying whether it's true or not to offend any conservatives. But that's the case, at least in the Nordic countries, that research and the facts are starting to challenge this mechanism of maintaining the dream world. And I think only good things can come from that, even though it might be uncomfortable in the short term.
Yeah. Now, what do you see as the future development of net censorship then in that regard? We've heard, I think England has at this stage, or the UK, implemented suggestions in terms of filters. I know Australia has also been spearheading this. A lot of this development comes with the charge of child pornography, of course. They are eyeing the worst of the worst of the internet, and then, you know, taking that as the prerequisite that we need to censor not only that, but all the other things that we don't culturally kind of agree with. So where do you think that debate is going to go, and how successful is the filtering and potential kind of firewalling, if you will, of the web be?
Well, I think you're making a great point here that, first, there is no censorship filter that is going to be effective. It is going to both under-censor and over-censor at the same time, meaning that it's going to censor things that should not have been caught, and it is going to miss things that, according to the rules, should have been caught. I think it's very important to realize that, again, just like terrorism, these are just excuses for power and control. If I'm being a bit provocative here, you mentioned child pornography, which is evidence of a horrible crime that has been committed. If you were to be happen to be filming a murder, which is an even more horrible crime, then you would be hailed as a hero because you could put the murderer in jail. However, if you happen to catch this particular crime on video, then you are getting a much, much harsher sentence than the child rapist, even though you're the guy bringing evidence against this molester to put him behind bars.
Mm.
So I'm arguing that this kind of censorship is protecting child molesters in a way that I completely don't agree with, because it forces people to erase any evidence they have of this horrible crime. And again, just like you bring up, it's in either case, whether you agree of the censorship of this particular that particular material or not, it's all just a huge wedge in the door to get objectionable political material into the censorship list, which has already happened in the United Kingdom. I mean, the instant you put pornography on the banned list, you'll inevitably see sex education being banned. You'll see abortion clinics being banned. You'll even see outlets for homosexuality being banned. It's a strive towards a very, very conservative conformism that won't hold in the long run, but might unleash very, very violently. Now, we are building a mass surveillance state that I think is horrible in many ways, but we can still roll that back. We can still roll it back. It's not too late yet. But at the risk of polling a Godwin here, there were reforms that were possible in Germany in 1933, which were not really possible in 1937. And that happened very, very quickly. If we get a complete surveillance state at this global scale, then that takes decades, if not centuries, to undo. So I'm very, very concerned about building this bridge, if you like, in time to when the next generation, who understands civil liberties and that they must apply online as well, have come into power and are pulling the strings, when they're in their 50s and 60s, maybe 20 or 30 years from now. It's those 20 or 30 years that we must defend the civil liberties online. And if we fail to do that, then the people who grow up today will never know what it feels like to have a thought to themselves. And I think that's a very scary thought.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Now, there is a chance here as well that we get a split, I guess, in what the internet is or will be in the future. And that's already there. We can kind of see that with the official web being one thing, and then you have kind of like the deep web or the dark internet, I guess. I don't know if they are separated per se, both of those terms, if there's different things, but nonetheless, it's you would get an official censored version of everything, and then you would get an undercurrent. And would that be, would that be a good thing per se, or would that just simply kind of, it would divide the people as opposed to, divide the information, I guess, in terms of where you are or where you want to swim? Because certainly you have maybe everything goes on one end of it and then means no censorship, but you get a, certain baggage with that as well, if you know what I mean, Rick.
Well, absolutely. But at the end of the day, I don't think you can blame a communications infrastructure for human nature. I saw somebody saying that the internet takes everything that it means to be human and amplifies it.
Right.
And I don't think you can blame the internet for the way humans behave. I think it was Bruce Schneier, the security expert, who famously said that if you try to apply a technological solution to a social problem, then you've either misunderstood the problem or the solution.
Yeah.
And is it, do we see dark aspects of humanity online? Absolutely. But was it better when we didn't see those dark aspects of humanity and could happily pretend they didn't exist?
No.
Or is it better that we see them, can deal with them, and perhaps address them?
Right. Yeah.
It's kind of like beggars in the street, if you like. I happily admit to being uncomfortable to seeing poor homeless people begging in the street. But it would absolutely kill my conscience if I took part in some action of just forcing them to go elsewhere out of my sight. So I didn't have to feel uncomfortable about people being less fortunate than I am.
Right. Yeah. Now, is there a feedback loop in the behavior and the media we do consume? So let's say that we have this schism of, you know, the deep web on one end, and then you have people who are only, or, I mean, again, it's what you said. I mean, we go back to that. Either it's something you have internally and something you're seeking because that's part of your makeup, and therefore you're in that environment. But I guess, again, just to kind of analyze that flip side a little bit, if we continue to move in those kinds of environments, will that feed back into the persons who do that, and they, you know, they become what they consume pretty much? Is there a danger there? In other words, I guess what I'm saying is, there any beneficial aspect to condoning or keeping that material kind of away from people, if you know what I mean?
Well, I don't think, being a bit cynical here, if you want to see horrible material, all you have to do is to watch the evening news on television.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not necessarily about what material is horrible, because that's readily acceptable on television 24/7. You can watch any movie where hundreds, if not thousands, of people die, and the most gruesome deaths, and it's almost celebrated by critics in Hollywood and whatnot. Rather, what it's about is whose horrible visions and whose horrible imagination is allowed to be seen. And that's when it becomes a much more sensitive issue, because it turns into the information privilege. Who is allowed to communicate and who is not? Who is allowed to be seen and who is not? Whose problems are allowed to get addressed? And who must suffer in solitude? And that's when it becomes really, really painful questions that you don't really normally think of. If somebody is suffering, then I would love a way to help them out with that. I don't want them to sit suffering in solitude. If somebody is posting awful nightmares, then I'm certain that somebody would want to shut that up because they don't want that in their field of vision.
Right.
And I'd say that there's probably people who want beggars off the street because they don't want those in their field of vision either. They would rather see them suffering in solitude. But that's not how I roll. That's not how I work. I would argue that all of humanity wins from having all the information available about what the world looks like. That way, we can help each other build a better world.
Very good. Now, just a couple of more things here before we wrap things up with this time. How do you think that the NSA situation will unravel from this point? And we had, you know, James Bamford with us a while back talking about what has been going on with the, you know, U.S. Cyber Command and everything else. And there were some interesting perspectives that there was actually an internal kind of a turf war, if you will, actually going on between the CIA and the NSA in terms of who were going to be the top dog when it comes to spying, you know, on the online community. And therefore, it's a potentiality that the exposure of the NSA that we've seen in the last, you know, year here now. So it is evidence of that little turf war, if you will. Do you think that this will help to dismantle the power of the NSA and the Cyber Command in the US, or is there something else going on here? And this will just, the behavior will be condoned. I think a New York judge recently argued that it was all perfectly legal, right? There was, they got the go-ahead pretty much to do what they always were doing.
I think it's also, it's always very interesting when you justify a behavior by saying it's legal.
Exactly, of course.
When you justify something by saying it's legal, to my ears, that means that you can't think of any moral justification for this behavior other than it happens to be not illegal. And there have been many atrocities and genocides through history that has been with full support of the law. So that's not saying that it's good or justifiable in any quantity or quality, I think. But you're absolutely right that there's a turf war going on. The the establishment in various countries are by no means homogeneous internally. There's always a very multifaceted face of all governments. What I think is happening right now is that the spying community is scrambling to repair this damage, because we've essentially seen the entire treasure chest. And I think we'll continue seeing spills, because most people weren't aware that things were this bad. I mean, we've been trying to blow the whistle for upwards of a decade, and we've been dismissed as tinfoil hat alarmists, more or less.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it turns out that we'd been severely underestimating what had been going on, to even our own shock. So will we see this? How will this turf will play out? I think it all comes down to, again, if a politician risks losing their office over this. Today, you have kind of a shadow government, if you like, that is the spying community, that has been given loose reins to do whatever they like, and politicians are actively placing themselves in a plausible deniability, meaning that, no, don't tell me what you're doing. I don't want to be able to be held accountable for this. Just deliver the results that I want. Essentially saying, go out and break the law, but then Mission Impossible style, if you get caught, we are going to pretend we don't know you.
Yeah.
So what needs to happen, again, and I keep coming back to this, is that politicians need to lose their jobs over this. Until that happens, the big picture won't change. And for politicians to lose their jobs over this, the sentiment needs to change. That hasn't happened yet, but I think the pendulum has started swinging in the right direction. You're seeing editorials questioning these cliches, like if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear.
Mm.
And they're just tearing them apart and shining the light on how dangerous such a cliche is. That wasn't the case a couple of years back. You're seeing people hail Edward Snowden as a hero. That didn't happen a couple of years back with the leaks we had then. So something has happened, and I'm cautiously optimistic that we're heading in a direction where people will start valuing their civil liberties once again, rather than seeing them as an obstacle in the hunt for ghost terrorists.
Right, yeah. Well, the point there is well taken, that you mentioned that there's no accountability. I mean, we have professional politicians in place. They are pretty much untouchable, and very rarely now and then they throw us, you know, one bone, if you will, and one guy kind of gets targeted in certain, you know, situations like that. But more or less, I see that it's something within the political system itself, which you know, kind of encourages that kind of behavior, and this idea that just because it happens to be in the public realm, there's no accountability. We've seen this tying back to how things occur in Sweden, for example, that just because it's in that untouchable realm of the authority, it's all fine, and you know, just move along, or we might change this or this a little bit here and there, but the basic kind of infrastructure of what is going on remains the same, and there will be new people in place to kind of fulfill that role. So it's a deeper problem, right? That's what really this is about.
It's definitely a systemic problem. I completely agree with that, and that is why this has to change at the election level. And there's a lot of inertia in the political system. I mean, most of Europe have proportional elections where you can, if you get 5% of the votes, you get 5% of the seats in parliament. The UK, France, and the United States have different political systems where you need a majority of the votes in a particular geographical area to get a single seat. And there's lots more inertia in such systems. So this does move slowly. But then again, it's taken us upwards of 30, 40 years to get to where we are, thinking that the FRA started wiretapping phone calls illegally in 1976. So if we can start rolling this back now, and I can look back 20 years from today and see that somewhere around these years was when we started to make a difference, then there is at least a world that I'll be happy to leave to my children.
Indeed, indeed. Very good point there. Now, yeah, I think that's we should begin to round things up for this time. I mean, I want to thank you, first of all, for your perspective from the Pirate Bay and your personal one as well. And you know, keep up the good work highlighting the issues that you do, talking about the things that you do. It's very important and good. So leave us with your details again, how people can, you know, reach you and read more from your stuff, Rick.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted. My name is Rick Falkvinge. That's Rick, R-I-C-K. Falkvinge. I am the founder of the Swedish and First Pirate Party, a net liberty movement and human rights movement that you can vote for. That's now spread to 70 countries. My blog is at falkvinge.net, falkvinge.net. I published two books, one on copyright reform together with Christian Engström, who's a member of the European Parliament, and one on a large-scale, cost-efficient leadership called Swarmwise. You can get them both for free from my website, or buy them in paperback if you like. And I think that's it.
All right, very good. Well, thanks again a bunch for your time, Rick. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, and good luck. Cheers.
Good stuff, good stuff. All right, I hope you enjoy this and learn something new and have some new things to consider. Upcoming, we have Radio 314 with Aaron Dykes and Melissa Melton from Truth Stream Media. Then on Red Ice Radio, we have Dan Fogler, Richard Dewhurst, Ben Davidson, Robert Felix, Sophia Smallstorm, William Lynn, and John King. A lot of good shows coming up, so stay with us. A special thanks goes out to all our wonderful members as well, who not only keep our broadcast going, but enables us to expand into future projects. Thank you, guys and gals. Have a great rest of your day, evening, or night, wherever you are, and we'll speak to you in just a few days.